With a bubble on top.
Would you take a couple minutes and go through the examples for us or with us, and then we'll open it up to questions?
Okay, first of all, what this is, again, this relates to the reinstatement of a minimum registration fee in statute. If the fee is reinstated with the amendments as we're proposing in the bill, there will be no change in the vehicle registration because we, as indicated, have not changed to what we believe the law now says. This is an example of the fees that we're now charging and what fees have historically paid, or vehicle owners have historically paid, versus what they would pay if the amendments in the bill were not to be made in relation to the minimum registration fee. The first example covers vehicles that are not prorated, those that are fully registered for use 100% of the time in Oregon. And it takes it uses the example of a truck at 8,000 pound weight, because the fees are based on the weight of the vehicle. And it shows that the fees for 1 year, if the owner of that truck renewed it for 1 year, they'd pay $35. If they renewed it on a quarterly basis for less than a full year, they'd pay $10 per quarter with the minimum fee, or $40. If under the vehicle code as amended by Senate Bill 113, if you take that same truck, again it would pay $35 for a full year if it renewed the vehicle if the owner renewed for a full year. If they renewed by quarters, they would pay $8.75 per quarter, or $35. It just go out the $35 divided by four. And as you can see, the only impact are on these lighter weight vehicles, because once the fee goes up to $40, regardless of whether you're renewing quarterly or this, you've got $10 fee anyway. So it only affects these lower weight classifications that get into the smaller fees. In addition to these differences, the statutes establish an additional dollar to be paid each time a vehicle is renewed on a quarterly basis, and these differences, as indicated, do not include that. The second example takes the same situation, basically, only on a truck that is being registered proportionally for use in other states. And you take the 8,001 pounds, and prorated vehicles are not allowed to be renewed quarterly, but their registration fee is reduced by 1/4 if they renew later on in the year. Prorated vehicles always run from January to December. The only vehicles impacted in the prorate area, again, are the lighter weight vehicles, and only if they're renewed only or registered only for the last quarter of the year. And here you take the $10 plus a percentage of the miles that travel in Oregon, and you come up with the Oregon fees. These carriers would also be, of course, paying fees for the other percentage of their miles to whatever state they're registered in. What they've historically paid is shown first, $10 at 25%. Under the code as amended by Senate Bill 113, 1/4 of that fee is $8.75, so we're taking 25% of $8.75 instead of $10.
If I may ask a question, are we now, and I maybe missed this early on, you're saying we want to go back to minimum fees, minimum registration fee. And again, what is the reasoning behind that?
Madam Chair, this change was made last session by Senate Bill 113. it was not requested in relation to Senate Bill 113, and we have no recollection of it ever being discussed in committee. We raised it to the interim committee because we thought it might have been an unintentional change, and we thought the issue should be addressed as to whether they wanted to put it back in or leave it out. They chose to put it in a bill to put it back in.
Okay, are there questions from the committee? Is there anyone here who served on the interim committee?
I did.
I wonder, Representative Rajani, if you could perhaps, because I am new on the committee and there are a couple of us who are, give me a better understanding of why this was so important. I can't see real changes in terms of the amount of fees charged, so I guess I need to understand, is it just for simplicity in meshing with the rest of the law that's there?
I've almost forgotten that, but unless Steve got a fresher.
Madam Chair, Representative Rajani, if I may. What happened during the interim is that the committee asked motor vehicles in the course of the interim to bring to our attention anything that was different, that they didn't know about. This one, while it's not a big problem as far as revenue goes into the Highway Fund for registration fees, was a change that, and a new policy question that the committee wasn't convinced really got aired or had a public hearing last session. This change, however slight, just didn't get a public hearing last time around. And so I guess the question before the body this time is, do you want the reduced fees? You know, is that important? Is it a significant amount of money into the highway fund, and how do you want to charge it? I don't think that the issue that we heard was an increase or decrease in paperwork or record keeping or anything like that. It clearly is a revenue issue, and whether or not it's significant enough. No one could remember that from during the interim that also served on the transportation committees during the session or during the subcommittee how it happened.
I don't remember. I was on the committee then, too.
Yeah. Can you give us a sense of what the overall impact might be? I mean, you've given us some examples. Have you gone further than that?
Madam Chair, we were unable to determine the total impact. We know that it's going to be relatively few vehicles involved in it in terms of revenue, because just basically because of the, I mean, most prorated vehicles are well over the weight limit, and but our records don't reflect whether a vehicle is being registered on a quarterly basis. We couldn't pull out statistics. We don't anticipate the revenue to be great. It will mean programming changes for our programs that calculate fees. It will also mean programming changes to the other jurisdictions who collect our fees. They'll have to change their programs, but it won't be a substantial impact.
Are there questions from committee members? Did you have something further you'd like to add?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make clear, we have proposed some amendments on page 8 in this area, and whether or not the amendment on line 4, page 8...
Now, we're dealing with the Xerox copy that was passed out. Okay. Page 8, line
4.
Thank you.
The amendment on line 4 deals with this minimum fee. And if you choose not to put that in, we still feel that the amendments on line 5 through 10 still need to be made. Line 5 through 10 relate to current law, and again, we see this problem of the statute referencing fees paid as opposed to the base, the fee that we base Oregon's portion of the fee on.
Could you explain what that base is, just the base part, how that's figured?
Madam Chair, say that Oregon fees are $10 or $100 or whatever. Let's say $10, and you only travel 10% of your miles in Oregon. Under the prorate agreement, we would calculate 10% of that $10 for the Oregon fees, and then we'd calculate whatever percent of miles you traveled in California for California's fees, in whatever. So the fee that you're actually paying goes to the different states, but you're not really paying one fourth of the Oregon's fees. We're using one fourth of the Oregon fees to the base.
Thank you.
So we feel that these changes do need to be made, whether or not the change in line four is made in conjunction with the minimum registration.
That helps. Thank you. Yes, Representative Norris.
Madam Chairman, the fees shown on pages 9 and 10, are those one-year fees?
Madam Chair, Representative Norris, yes, they are.
I'd only been used to a two-year cycle with the vehicles that I own, and this was sort of new to me. There are certain vehicles I take that are registered for 1 year or less than 1 year.
Madam Chair, Representative Norris, most of your trucks, your heavy trucks, your heavy trailers, and your buses are registered on a yearly basis as opposed to a biannual basis.
Okay. Might follow that up is all farm vehicles do like December to December. So.
I just didn't really see the coverage in here that provided for the vehicles that I own.
Motorhomes are the same under that same classification, I think, another year by year.
Madam Chair, Representative Brajati, no, motorhomes are on a biennial basis.
Oh, are they? Mm-hmm. I don't have one, so I didn't know.
Mr. Lee, go ahead.
Madam Chair, if I may, this isn't scheduled for a work session today. And if it's the committee's pleasure, I'd be willing to work with Motor Vehicles and the other individuals to follow Motor Vehicles on all the sets of amendments that are proposed to this bill and bring them back for a work session.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Thank you.
One other question.
Yes.
What have been the problems that have arisen with the special plates for the veterans?
Madam Chair, Representative Young. Veterans aren't covered in this bill. Did you have a specific
prisoner of war?
Okay.
I guess they
to my knowledge, there isn't a problem. The change that we had originally discussed related to just clarifying that the statute applied to motor vehicles because it was confusing. It says motor vehicles, but then it references some trailers. When Legislative Council drafted the bill, and I'm not sure whether they did this to raise a policy issue or whatever, they deleted language also that would put these vehicles paying the same registration fee as like vehicles that didn't have prisoner of war. I don't know that there's a problem with that. We don't know why they got a flat fee. For the motorcycles, it would make them pay more by getting prisoner of war plates. For motorhomes, it would make them pay, excuse me, the way the law currently reads, if you have a prisoner of war plate and you have a motorcycle, you are paying more because you're paying $20 instead of $6. If you have a motorhome, you're paying less because you're paying $20 rather than at least $36 or maybe even more. The way this bill is amended now, it would put them in the same status as any other motorcycle or motorhome. You'd pay your $6 motorcycle or moped fee, and you would pay your motorhome fees based on your length. And as far as I know, there's not a problem. It's just a question of whether the committee wants to put them on an equal status with like vehicles.
Mr. Lee, perhaps you can shed some light on this.
Madam Chair, while the policy question is clearly before members because of the way the bill drafted, it was an error on my and council part in misinterpreting what the problem was. We only went to fix their problem, and the fact that this law is amended, it was not the question that the interim committee really was trying to address. It was not trying to change these fees for the way in the significant manner that happened. It was kind of a drafting oversight, I would say, and I'll assume responsibility for that. But the question is here, and if the committee wants it to go back to the way it probably should have been and always has been, that's a decision.
But
Representative Young.
Basically, if we don't change anything, they can get their motorhome registration considerably cheaper.
If you pass the bill as it currently stands, they'll get it for the same price as any other motor vehicles. If you don't change the law as it now stands, they'll get it cheaper, yes.
The other thing, you have to make a special plate for that, right?
Correct.
So it wouldn't be unreasonable to say if you wanted a special plate for a motorcycle that you might have to pay more for that special plate, 20 instead of 6, because I assume that you can't get those smaller ones redone in a small quantity for a very reasonable price.
Madam Chair, Representative Young, I'm not sure what the actual price is on it. It's not the same as a custom plate where you're ordering them individually. We do have the plates in a smaller size, and probably once any fee for the initial die or stamping of that plate is paid, I don't believe it costs us that much more to produce those.
So you do have the plates for motorhomes and motorcycles and mopeds with the XPOW on it?
We do for the motorhomes, yes, I'm sure we do.
Any other questions? Have you any more to... I just came to my thoughts here. We ought to be voting on something right now.
Sure.
Got all the good guys.
It's the first time we've been on the committee where the Republicans are in the majority. Thank you.
Follow the House. Follow the House.
Wanda, you want to step forward?
Now, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. For the record, I'm Wanda Weyes, Executive Director for the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. Our association supports this bill in a couple of areas. One is the security interest holder portion of it, which our people are very concerned about because many of them do some financing. And the secondly, we are very pleased to see the question of the notification to motor vehicle of vehicles acquired settle as to whether or not it is out-of-state cars, because that question's been asked several times. I'm here to ask whether we could amend this bill to do a very simple thing. The 1985 legislature, when it passed the odometer bill, had a requirement that all buyers and all sellers had to certify as to the mileage. And on the back of your of the testimony there, you'll find a copy of the Federal Odometer Act. The Oregon law was patterned after those requirements. Obviously, the buyer cannot testify as to the accuracy of the mileage, nor can he testify as to whether or not the odometer has been repaired or replaced. So what we are simply asking is we would like to have an amendment to this bill that would require the buyer to report the mileage as it is shown on the odometer, but would remove the requirement that he make a certification as to the accuracy of the mileage or as to the replacement or repair of the odometer.
Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, asking questions, I too, in this instance, would be willing to sit down with Wanda prior to the work session and do a separate set of amendments with her proposal and bring them back before the committee, if that's the committee's pleasure.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Was there a reason for Wanda, was there a reason that these things were drafted in this way? Doesn't seem an undue hardship on a buyer to say that I certify that to the best of my knowledge, the odometer reading is accurate. I could probably envision a situation in which the buyer would have knowledge as to whether that might be accurate or not. In many cases, they wouldn't, but in interfamily transfers and among friends and so on.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, that's true. It does say to the best of my knowledge. The only reason that we have proposed the amendment is because motor vehicle has run into some problems with people coming up to the window and saying, I can't certify that this is actual mileage. And when you remember that about 60 to 65% of the cars are sold between individuals and not through the dealer, our dealers have run into the problem and the bankers have run into the problem with the buyer saying, I don't want to sign that because I don't know. And
okay.
That's the reason
okay.
for it.
Yeah, that's reasonable. Okay.
Any other questions from the committee? Well, Representative Norris.
Mr. Chairman, we'd be talking about a modification of this particular form, then, wouldn't we? With some different language in the form?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norris, no, that is a federal form, and we would not. But we would be talking about a modification on the title documents and the registration documents for motor vehicle, yes. So the buyer would report the mileage as it is shown, but he would not testify as to the accuracy of the mileage or the
But they'd still be certifying on this federal form?
That is still required, yes, sir.
Could we carry this one step farther and ask the U.S. Congress to change this, or is this just a regulation, or is it a federal law?
It is a federal law, and in addition, sir, as I believe I mentioned in the testimony, there is a new federal law that says that no state may issue a title without the odometer on it, and those rules will be going into effect. Hopefully, Oregon will just be able to slip in with their bill, and it will be accepted by the federal government because it seems to cover, I think Motor Vehicle believes at least, that it will cover most of the requirements of the new federal law.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norris, in drafting the legislation last session, the odometer bill, that federal law coming on board was kind of taken into consideration, and I remember the AG and all the people working on it, so that we knew that the bill, the law, our law should not be preempted by federal law, that we would be okay. So we shouldn't have our law rejected. We should be in compliance when it becomes effective.
Well, and two, actually, this has only been in effect 1 year. We just put it in the last session. So they really haven't had much of a chance to prove themselves. I think it's something that we needed.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Actually, I find the law sort of handy because whenever I wonder if it's time for an oil change, I look at my registration now and say, oh, yeah, it's been 3,000, 6,000, 9,000 miles since I bought the car.
Well, it's been very helpful then, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Maybe this question would go to Joanne. I just re-registered one of my cars, one I've had for a long, long time, but I had to make a statement on the back of the application of the mileage. Well, I'm not selling it. I had no intention of selling it. Why do we do that on these interim registrations?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Norris, we had asked for that in the bill last session, and the Attorney General very definitely wanted it in the bill last session to create a paper trail, that is, so that they could go back and check. The national figures show that you exchange cars or buy a different car every 6.7 years. So the opportunity to turn that back if you keep your car 7 to 10 years might be a little bit of an interest to some unscrupulous people. So if
it'll
it's registered every 2 years.
Next month, but
that's still going strong. Good used car.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Will we have the amendments drafted to do what Wanda would like?
Steve said he would work with her, and the next
time we have it, the work session on it, we'll have those amendments and others brought up to date.
One other
yes,
comment.
Yes, Representative
Young. Madam Chair, I have a bill in that would exempt motorhomes from the DEQ requirements if they're driven less than 1,000 miles per year in the zones that are covered by the emission test. And the interim, when you re-register, having to put the mileage down would be a good test of for anybody who wanted to challenge whether the motorhome was actually driven that much in that area, because it would require people to keep a log of the amount of miles they were outside the area. So that's a real good requirement. And I checked to make certain that you had to update that.
1,000 miles, huh?
Within the area.
Within the area.
Right.
That is housed or, I mean, home or?
Well, the reason for the bill is that many people have motorhomes in the Portland area, actually drive them 95 to 98% of the time outside of the area that they have concerns over the emissions. And so if a person chooses to opt out on the DEQ test, then they would just simply keep track of the number of miles that they travel in the Portland metropolitan area. The other problem is that a lot of people basically winterize their motor homes. And sometimes the renewal time comes up at a time when it's not insured and it's basically in dry dock. And so then you have to go through the problem of taking it down, getting your tune-up at that time, doing everything to meet the DEQ and get it re-registered and everything. And so it would ease that problem, too.
Sure. I like your expression, dry dock. This fits it down here pretty well. Now, in our country, it wouldn't be. It'd be stored.
I knew you were a nautical.
Are there any other questions from committee members? Thank you, Wanda.
Thank you,
we certainly will be working with you on the amendment.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who has any amendments to bring forward or who would like to offer some comments? If so, I assume these people will be in touch with the committee administrator. This closes the hearing on 2209, and we'll open the hearing now on Senate Bill 94. We have Bill Seeley from the DMV to testify.
We're packed through these foreigners.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bill Seeley, representing Motor Vehicles Division. Senate Bill 94 exempts vehicles owned and operated by foreign consuls from Oregon's titling and registration requirements. Oregon law right now requires the vehicles to be titled and registered just as any other vehicle. It also states that no fee will be charged for the registration and provides for a distinctive registration plate. The authority to do this is no longer necessary since the U.S. Department of State has assumed the responsibility for titling and registration of vehicles owned by foreign nationals who are serving as foreign consuls. They implemented the program in 1985, and it affected 7 vehicles owned by foreign nationals in the Japanese consulate in Portland. The Oregon titles were turned in along with the registration plates and a federal document serving as a title along with federal plates that identify them as foreign nationals were issued to the vehicle. We've already gone through that conversion process with the U.S. Department of State and with the Japanese consulate in Portland. The problem and the reason for Senate Bill 94 is that it raises a conflict in Oregon law. They're still required to be titled and registered here, even though they aren't. And we'd like to have that conflict resolved simply by saying if they are titled and registered by the U.S. Department of State, then they are exempt from Oregon's titling and registration requirements. There's no reciprocity question. I mean, they have reciprocity rights, so there's no question about operation here in Oregon. It's just a technical matter. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you. It certainly doesn't seem complicated. Are there questions from committee members? Representative Bouchard.
What happens overseas with our people if we happen to be in Germany or whatever? Are we, do we have to license a vehicle in that country?
Madam Chair, Representative Rajati, I'm not exactly sure. I believe it changes depending on the country you're in, just from some exposure I've had to it in the past. I guess I really can't answer that. I can find that out if you're interested.
Well, no, I'm just curious more than...
Are there any further questions from... Yes, Representative.
Where the
Hillis.
Japanese are concerned, could we say this applies only to Fords and Chevys?
Madam Chair, Representative Norris, trying to think back just what kind of vehicles they owned.
Finally, Chrysler.
Cadillac, Knowles, four Hondas.
Pretty good response.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Young.
If there isn't any further discussion.
Yes. That ends discussion. Are we opening this for work session? Okay.
Madam Chair,
I hear a motion? Yes.
I've moved Senate Bill 94 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Any further comments?
Do some regulation over their vehicles with regard to restraints and safety systems for the kids in the buses and the vans and whatever. And so what this bill is doing is saying, well, we don't want Department of Education vehicles under motor vehicle standards, but rather under Department of Education standards for seatbelts. And so that's what this bill does, basically. It removes them from having to comply with motor vehicle standards for seatbelts and safety systems and puts them under the jurisdiction of the Department of Education
standards.
Okay,
then a follow-up. Whose standards are more restrictive?
That I cannot answer. I mean, I haven't done a comparison.
Can you answer that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jolin, Department of Education has adopted the same federal standards that we have. I don't have a copy of what you handed out the other day, but it refers to the federal safety standard 209 and 210 in their rules that they have adopted.
Okay. Then the last question I would have, how is this going to affect a school district and their buses? Reason I ask that is I know in Lane County, not in one of my school districts, but there's been a great debate, and I'm sure throughout the state, of how to deal with the issue of belting up the bus situations, whether to when you're, especially if you're dealing with a used bus, not a brand new bus that may or may not be capable or fitted with seat belts. How will this relate to that?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
The seatbelt ready issue is not a requirement for DOE in the adoption of for Department of Education in their standards. They are not required to put in their seatbelt language standards that buses be seatbelt ready. This standards do not require that seatbelts be on buses, but if they do, they must comply with these standards. There is a bill in the Senate, and the number escapes me, at the interim committee introduced, mm-hmm. that says that buses shall be seatbelt ready, school buses. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, you say that the seats have to be not 24, but at least 28 inches high. There has to be these kind of bolts on it. But that's not law, and so I don't think that there are standards. And we've had copies, they don't reflect what to do to make a bus seatbelt ready, be it old or new. Did that answer your question?
Representative Dolan?
Yes.
I did a little checking on this because of some constituents that were concerned about the seat belts. And one thing that came up was that educational districts were more comfortable dealing with the Department of Ed because they had a continual line of communication with them. And I don't think it had anything to do with anything other than that, that they just had a continual newsletters, updates, and things like that going out, and it was kind of an in-house thing. And that's why they were more comfortable with the regulations there. It turns out that a lot of the concern with seatbelts in school buses was that if you had the seatbelts there, how can you justify youngsters standing up in the bus, which happens in a lot of school districts. And so I think they were a little leery of that requirement because it could mean additional buses, because for the last 15 minutes of a bus run, you might have 20 kids standing in the aisles in a lot of the school districts. And so they were concerned about just blanket requirements of seat belts, and then liability if you had one seat, two seat belts or lap belts for each seat, and then people standing in the aisles kind of running contrary to your own requirements on it. And I know there was that somebody is looking into the requirement of having seat belts on buses where youngsters are on for longer than a certain period of time, like for activities and that sort of thing, with the idea that the exposure to a potential accident is longer if you're going from here to Grants Pass, for instance, that just the possibilities of an accident are greater because of the length of time that the youngsters are in there. But those were some of the reasons that were shared with me for wanting to make sure that it was in the Department of Ed and looking at those requirements rather than just in DMV, where each district would have to start a new line of communications every time they had a question.
Yeah, I might add, just to follow up on that, during the interim we had a couple of other bus-related issues.
Mm-hmm.
And dealing with, in working through that, I worked with the Department of Education and the Oregon Pupil Transportation Association, which tends to be representatives from school districts, from the local school districts, who make up a statewide association that also are the ones that deal with moving the kids to and from school.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Department of Ed rep there too. So this group works real well together, just to follow up on that. And in showing them this bill and all the other ones, they seem to like this idea, you know, that the Department of Ed was the agency that they dealt with rather than the Motor Vehicles Division. But as far as questions on retrofitting and where they are and all that stuff, I mean, that might be a good organization, and the people in that group might be the ones that might be able to answer some of those questions and be the people that you want to talk to when making policy decisions about seatbelt requirements.
Okay. I just needed to step through this in my mind, and I'm satisfied now. Thank you.
Any other questions of Mr. Ivey while we have him in the box? Thank you. What is the committee's pleasure on House Bill 2207? Not hearing a lot of indications. I'll move House Bill 2207 to the floor with the passed recommendation. Were there amendments?
No.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Dolan.
I would have moved it for you. It's just, anytime you start talking about seat belts, I get a little nervous. I don't know if that was the feeling of any of the other members sitting in this room. I'll be glad and will support it. It's a good bill, but I would be very reluctant to carry it.
Okay. The chair will note that voting in the affirmative does not necessarily mean a willingness to carry or even wholeheartedly support the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move a unanimous motion.
Okay, it's been moved that we move House Bill 2207 to the floor with the unanimous vote from the Transportation Committee. Any objections? Hearing none, House Bill 2207 is moved to the floor. Okay, work session on House Bill 2213. Steve, do you want to bring us up to speed? Yes. Who would like to carry that?
I will carry it. Noting that carrying the bill does not necessarily indicate a wholehearted support for everything in the bill and so on. What is 2213?
House Bill 2213 does another, a lot of things. It deals more specifically with driver licenses.
Don't say it does a lot of things. That makes everybody nervous.
It deals with driving privileges generally. One of the things that it does is talks about undue hardship and cancellation of driving privileges there in Section 1. It's really back before us today because the Department of Motor Vehicles had proposed some amendments to Section 4 of the bill that dealt with cancellation of license driving privileges when they received information out of state and how to do that and how they dealt with that. Well, the way the bill was drafted, and they thought, and we thought during the interim, that that was the way to fix their problem by deleting all the language in ORS 809-400, well, that doesn't seem to be the way that they need to fix the problem. So the amendments were proposed by Motor Vehicles at the last meeting, and Tony DiLorenzo is here to answer questions and to talk about the amendments and why it didn't work the old way and why it works now with the amendments.
Where are the amendments?
They're on their way.
They're coming right now.
The courier is rounding the bend.
There's a hand in gross.
Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tony DiLorenzo, Motor Vehicles Division. As Steve has indicated, we originally proposed deletion of most of 809-400 as a way to fix a problem that turned up in the code rewrite. The code rewrite inadvertently expanded our authority to suspend based on suspensions from another state. Good grief, we don't want to, and you'll notice that in its original form, 809-400 is a shall, not a may, and we thought, wow, that's going to cause all kinds of problems. For one thing, it's in direct conflict with the motor license compact. We do now get not only drunk driving convictions from other state, but we get suspensions that come along with them, and with the way 809-400 came out of the code rewrite, we would be faced with one set of suspension periods under the compact from the conviction, but having to do something completely different based on the suspension under 809-400. So our original thought was we'd just scrap the whole thing. We've had second thoughts, though, and we think that with a may in there instead of shall, that authority is potentially useful. We may have some things we could do to enhance traffic safety with it. So we're proposing that it simply be made a may rather than a shall, and to take out the reference to financial responsibility. There are going to be many situations where we might want to suspend somebody but not require them to have to file an SI-22 insurance certificate. So we respectfully submit that we simply leave that authority in but make it discretionary. In that way, as I've indicated to the committee, we're on record as saying that we would exercise that authority only through the administrative rulemaking process. So we would be public with what we plan to do with it.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Yes.
Mr. DiLorenzo, in doing my staff work and going through the index, you see, I found another bill that deals with this same section that's in the Judiciary Committee.
Yes.
What's happening with that bill, and what do these amendments or this bill and its potential passage do to what's happening with that bill in Judiciary?
Mr. Chairman, Steve, that's the bill you speak of is House Bill 2062, and what it was, our original concept was we would
what 2062 deals with is implied consent suspensions. What it does is it gives us the authority to suspend here when somebody refuses or fails the breath test in another state. And our original concept was we'll do away with this authority here in 809-400 and we'll create a new authority over here, circumscribed with all kinds of, you know, due process protections and so forth. And that bill is still before the committee, is scheduled for another work session, I believe, probably next week sometime. Right now, there is only a very minor conflict between the two bills, almost a technical one, in subsection 4 of 809-360. But I think we still think both bills are appropriate.
So I trust that you will track the bills close enough to make them...
In fact, what I would propose to do, assuming the committee approves these amendments, we have proposed them, what we would propose to do when we go into the work session in House Judiciary on 2062 is to propose amendments to 809-360 sub 4 to bring them into full so that they agree with what's being done with 2213.
And finally, do these amendments have anything to do with the hearing problem that the Judiciary Bill is having about who does the suspension hearings, the courts or you?
No, this authority is silent on any kind of hearing rights.
Okay.
And the problem, and we wouldn't, whereas we thought, you know, some people have said, Brad Swank in particular, looked at 809-400 and said, well, good grief, you know, DMV, you could be doing that with this authority right now. Why did you propose this other bill? Our feeling, though, is that this, even the way it's drafted, it's still probably not an appropriate vehicle for implied consent suspensions. And we thought implied consent suspensions was a sensitive enough issue, that whole area, that whole thing should be debated as a legislative change. We wouldn't have felt entirely comfortable trying to use this authority here to embark on what amounts to a conceptually important extension of the implied consent law. We thought it ought to be debated on its merits.
Yeah,
so that's why we did it as a separate bill.
We had that conversation during the interim about that implied consent bill, and I'm glad, from my perspective, that you were able to deal with that stuff in Judiciary, because this committee traditionally does not get implied consent DUII-related stuff, and it probably more we wouldn't have gotten the rest of this stuff.
There's a whole number of questions that have come up here about due process and so forth, and I think that's an appropriate way to deal with it.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
It's safe to say then that what they're doing is narrow enough that we're not going to overlap or conflict in any way with what they're doing with their bill.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's safe to say, and the House Judiciary Committee is aware of this bill as well. Their legal counsel is familiar with this, and I will be sure to point out that minor conflict between the two bills so that we don't pass two different versions of the same thing.
There are other questions from the few of us left. It's been a real come and go morning here. Is there anyone else testifying on this
work session?
We're in work session. Boy, you leave and things move right along. Are we ready for a motion on this? Could I hear a motion from?
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move that we accept the amendments to House Bill 2213 as hand and gross on the document called Motor Vehicles Division, date 2/12/87.
Representative Young has moved that we adopt the hand and gross amendments to House Bill 2213. And move the amendments plus passage of the bill to the floor.
Probably should move the
amendments separately. Yes. Okay, let's deal with the amendments first. Are there any objection to the amendments? Okay, if you would show a unanimous vote in favor of the amendments. And now to the bill itself. Is there a motion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Joel.
Before we go with a motion, I'd like to ask staff or whoever, on page 2, lines 36 through about 42, what are we, I can read as well as anybody else, but what are we actually doing by adding that language? This deals with the waiver.
Of the fee for the medical, the reason, do you want to come up and explain that one, Tony, please?
Tony Dealer, Engine Motor Vehicles. Mr. Chair, Representative Jolin. It is clear in the new motor vehicle code that we do not have authority to waive the reinstatement fee for people who we suspend because they don't get required medical clearance. That's very clear. This makes it clear that we have that authority. Right now, as I think, as I explained earlier to the committee, we are, in effect, when we issue suspensions for failure to obtain required medical clearance, we're sticking in another subsection of our suspension law, which does allow waiving of the fee. So we are waiving the fee for these people right now. But our legal counsel advised us that that's an acceptable interim measure, but that we really need to bring that to get it resolved legislatively.
Okay.
And the fee is $44.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. I have some kind of physical problem, and so you have suspended my license. And normally I would have to pay the fee of $44 and go to a doctor and have the doctor probably write me a little note so that I could deliver it to you saying that that physical problem went away, Peg's okay, she can drive now. But in this language you say that you're going to let me waive the fee if I don't take an examination upon request of the division, if I don't obtain required medical clearance upon request of the division, if I well, so on and so forth. That's the way I'm reading this. You can waive the fee if I don't comply with your request. Is that what that's saying?
Yeah.
Explain that to me.
Well,
somebody, please.
Mr. DiLorenzo is looking. I think it's saying that the suspension would come because you failed to go in and take a test, which might have been for a health reason. Maybe the reason you didn't go in and take the test was that you were in a wheelchair and in the process of recovering from an illness or something else. And so you were suspended because you didn't take the test. When they find out that you are able, then your suspension came because you didn't take the test. And they're saying that they're not going to penalize you because you were suspended for reasons you had very little control over.
Is that what you're saying?
The same with when the physician sends it in. You know, you don't have, there's nothing that can reverse that process, as I understand it, except going through the Dr. Foster.
Yes, through the state, the state medical.
It's more than just taking a note from your friendly chiropractor or naturopath down to the DMV. It has to go through a process.
Mr. DiLorenzo, will you explain that process a little, please, for us so that we can all understand how it works, what exactly happens?
In just very broad outline, first, we learn about people who have medical conditions that may affect their driving in a number of different ways, but one of them is that physicians are required by statute, and I don't have the exact site, to report to the state medical officer any patients they have who suffer from conditions that may cause momentary or prolonged loss of consciousness. And when the medical officer, state medical officer, gets those recommendations, he reviews those reports, and if it looks like we've got somebody who may pass out behind the wheel of a car, the medical officer will recommend that we take suspension action. And we will, in those cases, usually suspend, you know, we process those as quickly as we can because they're, you know, there's possibly a serious threat to highway safety. Then the person must then go back through our medical review process, and it's laid out in statute. They must go to their doctor, have their doctor prepare a report on their condition, and that full report then goes to the medical officer, who then reviews it, makes a recommendation to us, and then we will either, in some cases, if it's turns out it's diabetes under proper control, we will recommend that immediate, you know, reinstatement, reinstate the license with the provision that they be re-examined perhaps annually. In some cases, it may turn out that that the condition is not nearly as serious as we thought, in which case the license will be reinstated unconditionally. In some cases, the suspension will remain in effect because the person just isn't safe to drive. Does that help clear it up? And the concept behind waiving the fee is that it's something over which the person had no control. We don't choose to get diabetes or not, but we do choose to drive drunk or not.
Thank you for bringing that up, Representative Jolin.
I just was a little confused. I'm not an attorney, and I like to make things perfectly clear.
Are there other concerns, questions, before we have a motion? Could I have a motion? House Bill 2213.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2213 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Are there any objections? Passes unanimously. Are there any objections to a unanimous vote? I'll get this down yet. Hearing none, it passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Everyone on the committee has just received, or perhaps a few moments ago, two LC drafts. Representative Hayden has asked that LC 2521 be introduced as a committee bill. Representative Minnis has asked that LC 1886 be introduced as a committee bill. I don't know, Representative Hayden, if you'd like to say a couple words of explanation, or you'd just like to have us act on it.
Be glad to answer any questions. Otherwise, I'd be pleased if the committee would act on the request.
Okay. Are there any objections to having these two LC drafts introduced as committee bills? Hearing none, they will be introduced as such.
Is there one reminder?
Yes.
Beginning Tuesday, my reminder is that we're going to start meeting at 8 o'clock. 8 a.m. The chairman has asked me to schedule the meetings so that we have more time in the morning. Floor sessions will be getting earlier as the time gets, as the bills start coming out of committee. And secondly, we have a rather strange agenda on Tuesday in that the committee and the Senate committee is hosting a reception for the newly appointed Oregon Transportation Commission. That occurs at 9:15 in the Galleria, which is down here on the first floor behind the guide desk, from 9:15 to 9:45. So we will meet at 8 o'clock. Go into recess at 9 o'clock, and then reconvene at 10 o'clock to finish up any business we can before the floor session.
Thank you. I forgot something again. Representative Jolin, would you be willing to carry 2213 to the floor? This is the one you just asked questions about, right? I suppose. That's unfair.
Punitive.
I suppose.
Thank you.
I had that down on my calendar as room 257.
Yes, we... got basically bumped out of the caucus room, you know, it's
we'll
a real
where,
safe
then?
Place. In the Galleria here, which is on the first floor behind the...
We're through? Yeah, why don't you do it?
In the open.
Yeah.
Get back
okay, thank you. Meeting is adjourned.
Great, I made it back.
Sorry, but...